This interview with Jermaine Bowden was recorded on February 22, 2022, during the Baltimore Youth Film Arts Workshop, Inside Stories, Perspectives on Incarceration.
My name is Jermaine Bowden. I got incarcerated in 1989 at the age of 17 years old. I was incarcerated for 30 years, from 17 to 48 years old. I've been home a year and a half for now.
And how old are you?
I'm 50 now.
50, okay. All right, so Amber, I know you want to ask your first question, so take it away, Amber.
Okay, how are you, Mr. Jermaine?
How you doing, sir?
I'm just going to first start off like, it's going to be a two-part question. What was your childhood like to get you incarcerated? That's one. And then can you just please take us back to that moment when you got incarcerated, when you got arrested, basically? For your crime?
Yes, ma'am. Okay. I was born in Washington, D.C. Then my mother and father moved to Prince George County, Maryland, Landover. I went to school, public school in Maryland, and I went to private school in Washington, D.C. Got tired of catching the Metro bus and the subway, hauling the books. I told my mother I wanted to go back to public school in Maryland. I was going to church and Bible study as a little child. We live in the houses, so my father, since I was 12 years old, I had to cut the neighborhood grass, rake leaves, shovel snow. I worked in a fast food restaurant, and I delivered a newspaper for the Washington Post. Once I left D.C. private school and I came back to Maryland school in the 7th, 8th grade, I met a friend, which was a good friend, and he told me about drugs. I would talk to you professional, proper, and I would talk to you slang because I have to use street terminology because in the streets, you know, you have urban slang, you have logos that they use. So in this form of drugs, which they call boat, but it's called PCP or love boat because that's what the terminology they use in Maryland, D.C. And then they call it coke, which is crack cocaine. In the era of the 80s, that was being sold in my generation. I was told that I could make $1,000 in a minute or a second. So in my illiterate young mind at 13, I was only making $400 every 2 weeks, just to say when I was working in a fast food restaurant. So I'm weighing the scale, said, well, why should I go to work if I can make $1,000 in a minute? At a young age, when you're seeing the money flow like that, it becomes addicted to the money. I never used drugs, I never drink, I never smoked a day in my life. I was addicted to the lifestyle, to the money. So once I got addicted to that fast money, I just stopped going to school. I stopped going to church and Bible study. I stopped working. I just lived a street life. So that's how I got caught up in the street life. I grew up in the house with my mother and father, with my brother and with my mother, good family. It was just addiction to the lifestyle. So I was on the strip. Man, that's another slang. The strip is nothing but a drug infested area where people sell drugs at, but they call it a strip. In the process of one of the drug strips that I was on, I was with two so-called friends. They shot a man, but they were trying to shoot another person. They hit a man. The man got shot one time. He died. That's how I got incarcerated. They came to my house like 6 in the morning and said, what's my name? I told my name, Jermaine Bowden. They said, you wanted for first-degree murder. So, because I'm in the same house that they came to. This is my mother and father house. So my mother and father still living. My father passed 2004. My mother still living. So I take care of my mother. When he came through the door and he said that, when he said first degree murder, like, who did I kill? Because once you kill somebody, first and foremost, your conscience, it'll be eating you up because you can't sleep with it. I was at peace because I know I never pulled the trigger to kill anybody. So I'm like, he's tripping. I'm using slang now. I'm like, he lunch. I know I ain't killed nobody. But when he was right here, when you come in the front door in the living room where my mother and father living room at, once he came to the front door and he put me on the closet wall because the closet in the living room, and he's putting the handcuffs on me. I was just tired. I was just tired of selling drugs. I wanted to get out. I just didn't know how to get out. I was just tired. So the first thing I just said to myself, I'm like, man, I'm through with this life. I was saying it to myself when he's putting the handcuffs on. So I was normal. I was at peace. I wasn't like, because I know I ain't killing nothing. So it didn't bother me. So when they was taking me out of my mother and father house, the officer was talking to me. I'm hearing him, but I'm not hearing him because I'm trying to figure out like who got killed. That's what my mind is racing at. I'm trying to think like who got killed, because you got to understand, in the 80s, in my generation, there wasn't no killing. It was only like neighborhood fights, baseball bat. My generation, wasn't nobody carrying up guns, killing up like it happened after the 90s. So I'm just listening to him, but I'm hearing him, not hearing him. So he's taking a turn. He's going down on, back then it was called George Palmer Highway, but now it's Martin Luther King Highway, right where the Redskins Stadium at. So when he's going up, my head is down. I'm just thinking, like, who got shot? I'm just trying, who got shot? And then it was like the Exodus, my, like, the, because I'm a Christian, I believe in God and Jesus. My head, it just did it by itself. It just raised up and it just turned. And it's the liquor store, because that's where the man got killed, in the liquor store. And that's when it hit me. So that's when it all came back to me. So that's how I got incarcerated. So from 89 till 2020, I was incarcerated for the 30 years.
For so, that. With that being said, because you were wrongfully accused, like, did you get any, like, I don't know, like, any money, anything, any...
No, that's one of the issues. That's one of the issues that I'm, you know, still fighting for going through court processes. When my judge first sentenced me to a life sentence, you know, they came out with the law that it was cruel and unusual punishment for a juvenile received life sentence, but the time that I came through, it wasn't no juveniles really coming through for murder. So it was something new, like never heard of. When I put in for a reconsideration, he denied it. But then later on down the line, like 2016, he opened it back up. He agreed for me to be evaluated, what they call the mental health and hygiene, to give me a court date to bring me back. But he died. So my trial judge died. So I didn't get a chance to see him to go over. I mean, it was like this close for me to be able to talk to him, to let him know who I was, because he never got a chance to really get to know me. He was only going off paper. I wanted to explain my situation, my lifestyle from 1989 to 2016 now, a big change, different. The lawyer that I had, he caught cancer, he died. So the judge, another judge that took the judge cases, she left and went to the Court of Appeal. So my case was on hold for 3 years. So I didn't go back to court till like 2020. So when I go in front of the judge, he like, listen, I have a 17-year-old man case on my file, been locked up for 30 years. I don't even know what to do. So he said, I'm gonna put it on hold because you're going up for parole. So when I went up for parole, they gave me parole. That's how I got out, because then the governor had to sign your parole to be released. So I'm out on parole as a lifer that the governor got me out. So when my 2 years up, I have to be able to put a petition in for reconsideration for them to suspend the life sentence. So I'm still fighting it as of today.
Who you got next, Ab?
Okay, so anybody has any more leading questions? If not, we can just talk about life during prison, and we can have Tavon take that away if you would like.
I just need wanted a clarification on what year he actually was released, because that could lead to another question I had.
2020, of May of 2020.
Okay. Anybody else have a leading question? No?
Okay, I was asking one more question, that's it. Basically, because of the lifestyle you live, so do you regret it, or is it like lesson learned?
Nah. Mm-mm. Nah, only thing I regret, who is this? This is
Amber.
Only thing I regret, Miss Amber, is disrespect my mother and father. Only thing I regret, disrespect my mother and father, because my mother and father raised me better than that. All they asked me to do was go to work and go to school. I did that. But I just got introduced to the drug game, to the fast money. As far as the lifestyle, I don't brag about it. I'm not proud of it. None of that. You know what I'm saying? I talk to the youth today and tell them it's your option. You're going to go to prison or you're going to get killed. Simple as that. So as me talking to youth in prison out here on the streets of society, that's the scale you're going to have to wear. If you want to live this lifestyle, it's only two options. So-called friends you think you're with now is not going to be with you. They're not coming to see you. They're not seeing your money. They're not going to accept the call. The females you with are going to leave you. So it's going to be lonely. So right now it looks good, but it's going to be lonely. But the lifestyle, it wasn't nothing that I did to brag about, because when I sold drugs for materialistic things. I sold drugs for clothes, shoes, and jewelry and cars. That's it. Because in the 80s, it was a fashion statement in Maryland, D.C., who can dress the best and who had the nice cars or who had the nice jewelry. So I sold drugs to get materialistic stuff. All the name brand stuff that came out, I went and had it. So you had to understand that me as 13, 14, and 15, having these expensive clothes on, driving nice cars, is like it makes you feel like you're sitting on top of the world, like you are important. So that's all it was that I lived the lifestyle for.
Okay. Thank you so much, Mr. Bowden. Tavon, you wanna take it away now?
I was gonna say, Mr. Bowden, you covered a lot of ground. And I'm still taking it in. But I want you to give us the picture of how you felt when you first entered the cell, like when the doors first shut.
Okay.
And you knew that you wasn't going to get out for who knows when.
Okay.
Did you think, like, was the materials worth it? Was it worth the money? Was it worth the fast cars? Was it worth all these things that you wanted, you know? Was it worth it, really? That's really what I'm saying. Was it worth it?
Yes, sir. Being incarcerated in 1989 as a youth, as a juvenile, when you usually you'll go down Boys Village or in Cheltenham, Maryland, or training school in Baltimore, Maryland. They put me in Upper Marlboro County Jail. In Upper Marlboro County Jail, they have a unit for juveniles, which was 11B. Unfortunately, it was a violation. That's one of my arguments in court. They never put me in a juvenile unit. They put me straight into the adult unit. So that was a violation because I was supposed to went in with the juveniles, which they didn't. They put me in the adult unit. But the thing about me, Tavon, because I lived a street life and I knew all the older folks that were selling drugs, when I went in there, I knew half of them. So it was like embrace of them teaching me how to bid, what I was supposed to do and what I was not supposed to do. When I walked into the unit, right there, it was an empty bunk. And right on the empty bunk, it was a Bible. On the Bible, it's a little thing on the right-hand corner. It's on the right-hand corner. On the Bible, I don't know if you can see it because, can you see it right here? This right here?
Yes, we can see it.
All right. Right there, that's a lamp on the Bible because, you know, back in the days in the Bible, they had to go through deserts with no electricity, so they had to use lamps to walk through their path so they could see. When I used to go into hotels and cut up coke and wet down boat, I'm talking slang, give it to you in a better terminology. Marijuana, weed or reefer, because it's different terminology in each generation. And you taking a bomb of fluid, you pull it on top of it, and you shake it up. That's what they call wetting it down. So that's how it turns a love boat, where they put chemicals on top. Crack cocaine, when you cutting it up, because you cutting it up into small pieces, 5, 10s, 15, 20s, like that. So when I'm in a hotel, I used to go into hotels and open the drawers. They always had a Bible, a pack of matches, and a bar of soap and the towels. When I used to go in hospitals and visit people, they always had the Bible there. So it was like God was knocking on my door, calling me back to get my attentions, telling me to come back to church to get out of the streets. But I didn't take heed to it. So when I walked to Marlboro County Jail, that Bible was on the bunk. The empty bunk that they put me on, the Bible was right there. Right there, Tavon. I got on my knees and I prayed and I said, Lord, please take all these materialistic lifestyle out of me because I hated it. I just wanted it taken away. First thing I did. Then I said, I want you, because I went to prison illiterate. By me stopped going to school, I went to prison on the third grade reading level and mentally as 8 years old. So I'm, you know how people are, it's two words. One, what they used to call retardation, but they use the word Down syndrome. All right, some you can tell because you can look at their face, you can tell. But mine's, you can't, mine's is in the brain, which I'm a slow learner. So it's hard for me to comprehend a lot of things. So it's hard for me to pick up things. So mentally I went in as an 8 year old and my reading level was on the third grade reading level because of me not going to school. So I said, Lord, I promise myself that I'm going to read the Bible every day. I'm going to read a newspaper every day, a magazine, a dictionary. I'm going to educate myself because I'm going to come out better than what I came in. So mentally, I wanted to come out better, but I wanted to come out the same way I came in physically because people use arms, legs, get stabbed in the eye. You know, a lot of things happen to people physically. So Tavon, I was at peace with myself. Because for one, I know I didn't kill a man. For two, I was through with that lifestyle. And for three, always had this will inside me and this faith inside me, Tavon, that I was going to get out of prison. regardless that they sentenced me to a life sentence. And from there, you go to Baltimore, which is DOC, MRDC. And from there, I went into Maryland State Penitentiary. So I'm 18 years old, going into a Maryland State Penitentiary where you got robbery, stabbings, killing, rape, all this going on into a place that I'd never been before. So it was like putting me in the military in a war where they don't teach you how to defend yourself. So I had to learn. The officer walked me through the yard. It was at night. He opened the door. All you have is a little box with your property, two sheets, soap and a washcloth, open the door, close the door, and that was it. So it was like I was on my own. So in the morning, they called breakfast, which I didn't hear, because you got mice, you got rats, you got roaches. I mean, it's cold. And the officer stepped in the cell like, you're going to breakfast. And then I got up and I just followed the dudes where they was going. Nobody told me what to do. You just had to be observative and just watch it. Everybody goes into the line. Then I'm in the kitchen. So that was my first experience going through the county jail, going through DOC, Don Nossett, then going through the Maryland State Penitentiary. So I always had this faith, Tavon, that I wasn't going to spend the rest of my life in prison, that I was going to get. I didn't know when. I didn't know how. I just had this motivation, this faith inside me that I was going to get out.
Was there any like really obscure or really like horrendous things that you witnessed during your time?
Most definitely. Most definitely. It becomes a culture shock because it's different to seeing somebody shot on the street than seeing somebody getting stabbed to death. You know what I'm saying? It will put you prison to numb you. Like when you're in the military and you see people shot, you just have to get used to it. So seeing people getting stabbed to death, you seeing blood, you hearing people holler, you hearing people run for their life. Yes, humanist, yes, horrible stuff where when you coming in and you seeing it, it's like it'll catch you. It's like a culture shock. You just stuck. You know what I'm saying? Because you seeing it, but after the years you start getting used to it, it becomes a norm. And it like you don't even feel like you human no more because of you just seeing it so much. It's like this everyday lifestyle.
I need one of the fellows to come in and kind of follow up on this flow that Mr. Jermaine has going right now. Some of the horrendous stuff. He said some things I know form some questions in your mind. Go ahead, Regia, is that you?
Yes. My question is regarding like towards the end of your time in prison. I know we were approaching the COVID pandemic, and I'm wondering kind of sort of how things in prison were dealt with in terms of like mental health and, well, you kind of addressed mental health, so like physical health and like kind of things around that nature, if that makes sense.
Miss Am, ain't no mental health and no physical health and no prison system. The prison or the correctional say they supposed to correct you. They don't correct you. I had to self-educate myself. I had to mental myself. I had to do my own self-awareness. So I had to teach myself how to do that. I didn't get no therapy. I ain't get no counseling. You understand where I'm coming from? The prison system is all about money. I ain't trying to educate or rehabilitate anybody. It's up to you if you're going to change, if you're going to better yourself. So I came to the conclusion, I'm not waiting on them. I'm going to do it myself. So my first thing is spirituality. You ain't going to be able to do nothing without your spirituality and your balance. So the first thing I had to do is tune back into my Lord. That's the first thing I did. Then second, I had to start reading and start educating myself. Third, I had to work out because I came in as a youth and I'm 90 pounds. And you know, you got people robbing, raping, and stabbing. You got to be able to defend yourself. So I had to work out to protect myself and take care of myself. And also doing a workout, a man came to me and told me when I was in the county jail of Marlboro, I should work out because it relieves misery, depression, and stress. I never heard that word before, but I couldn't let him know because you vulnerable, you weak, you can't reveal your weakness in prison. But, you know, me being illiterate, I never knew what misery, depression, stress, I never heard them words before. But what I started to do, I started working out in the corner by myself and I started feeling good. Then I said, oh, this is what it do to you working out. If it helps relieve stress, anger, depression. So that was my one, my self-awareness, what I did for health-wise to make me healthy. So that's how I got into exercise and working out, you know, to take care of myself. And far as counseling, you know what I'm saying? I had to start reading, studying the how to deal with this thing mentally to help me get over this hump from all this pain and suffering that I'm going through. So I had to do that myself, Miss Sam. And to the release. Okay, when I went up for parole, they said that being though you've been locked up for 30 years, you have to go through camp, pre-release, work release, because that will adjust you back into society because you've been gone away from society for so long. So they will send you from prison to a camp, pre-release, work release, where you're supposed to be able to go to work on the street so you can adjust back to society and then come back to the prison. Lo and behold, they shut everything down for people to be able to go to work on society because COVID just came out. So I never got a chance to go work on the street to adjust in society and to come back to prison. So they said there's no reason for them to keep us here because they're not letting people go to work, so they released us. So by me being released in prison, I already educated myself in prison and planned what I was going to do once I've been released on prison. I wasn't going to let them throw in my face that you've been locked up since you were 17 years old. You don't have a college degree. You don't have an education. So we're not going to give you a job. So like I said, when I was small, my father had me cut neighborhood grass. I said, I'm going to go home and buy me a lawnmower. I'm going to run and get my own business. I was in the prison cell. Vistaprint came on TV and said, we'll print 500 cars for you for $9.99. Put the TV on freeze. I wrote that down. Second, I worked in the tag shop for 13 years in the prison system, and I pressed license plate tag for the whole state of Maryland. So what I did, I saved my money first to buy me a private investigator to get all my legal paperwork, my transcripts and stuff, to hire a lawyer. I took care of that, would help my family, and then I saved the money so I can buy me a pickup truck so I can use the pickup truck to go around cutting grass and hauling stuff. So I came home, I had to go to driver's ed school because I never had a license before. It was $362 for 2 weeks. I went and got me an ID, $24 from the Maryland Vehicle Department. Then I had to do 6 hours with the drive instruction and 14 hours with my sister, whoever car you want to use. I took the learner's pass that. You had to wait 90 days. I went to take the driver's test. I passed that. Soon I did that, I went and bought that pickup truck. I got the pickup truck, put the lawn on the back, got my cars, I go around passing. So that was my side job. I cut grass and I haul stuff. That's my side money to create my own business. I wasn't waiting on society because it's this catch 22 in the system. You don't have a job, you come see your parole probation officer, we're giving you an honesty. If you violate, we're gonna send you back to prison. I just gave you 30 years, I'm not going back to prison. So, it's three places to work at. My mother and father live in Lando. My father worked for Metro for 25 years. I supposed to went there after I graduated from high school to drive the bus. I'm a filler application out there. Federal Express was around the corner, 5 minutes from my mother and father house. I fill an application there. UPS is 5 minutes from my mother and father house. I'm going to fill it from there. Why? Because I knew I would have to walk to work. I'm either had to ride my bike or I'm going to have to jog to work. So I didn't have to worry about transportation, so I knew I had to get a job close by. I came out in May. I filled the application. Well, I couldn't go to Metro because I didn't have my driver's license. Federal Express closed down. They put Fairmont High School there. They took the building. UPS was open. I put the application in Friday. They told me Monday to come for an interview. They hired me June the 16th part-time. So I've been working at UPS since I've been home from June up to now. I got to go to work tonight. Soon I get off the Zoom with y'all.
Well, okay. I hope we're not holding you up, are we?
It ain't even about that, Mr. Stan. It's about helping people and helping youth so they don't have to go to prison as I did as a young age. So if I can educate y'all and y'all can go spread the word to other people, then I'm doing my deed what I'm supposed to do.
Man, we love you for that.
That is really so inspiring.
So go ahead. Yeah, so Edward has a question.
Okay. How you doing today, Edward?
Hey, how are you?
How you feeling?
Good. So back to what you said before about when you were in prison.
Yes,
and,
sir.
Like all that horrible stuff that you saw.
Yes, sir.
Was there anything that stood out to you that was particularly bad?
Man, it's so many. Ever when you see somebody getting stabbed to death and hollering for their life, and you see the life coming out somebody, that'll mess you up. I mean, where you can't eat, I mean, you can't sleep. I mean, because you're a human and you hearing people hollering for their mother. You know, that's their last, but you're in prison and you hollering for your mother. You know, you would never, you know, hear that, you know, that scream. You know, you can never forget that you're seeing blood gushing out somebody. You know what I'm saying? Because it's a difference I have learned in prison from regular blood and dark blood. You know, you learn stuff by not even being a doctor when you're seeing regular blood because you just got hit in your flesh. Dark blood because you got hit in your veins, your arteries, and it gushes out. You know what I'm saying? It's like a flow, like a river, like a water faucet. You know, and this stuff is just splashing. You know, you're seeing fingerprints on the wall because people are running for their lives. You know, you have the blood get on you because you have to get out of that way. So that stuff traumatize you, you know, if you let it and it mess you up mentally. So I had to deal with it differently. So, yes. Yeah.
So did you see that happen like often? Was that like a regular occurrence?
Oh, most definitely. Yeah. Yeah, most definitely.
Mm-hmm. That's terrible.
Yes, almost. Thank you. Terrible. Yes.
I need one of the fellows to please ask a question regarding Mr. Jermaine's dealing with anger or whatever emotions, knowing you're being wrongly convicted. So, can somebody form a question and then condense it so that you don't stretch the question out? That you just keep it short and ask him about that topic I just mentioned. Say anger versus being wrongly convicted. Any question that comes to mind like that? Anybody?
Are you angry?
Oh, no, ma'am. No, ma'am, Miss Amber, because my spirituality. See, my spirituality, I'm at peace. You see what I'm saying? Because sometimes God has to use people for certain situations. And I feel like my family tell me God is using you as a vessel. So the vessel is that you have to testify and that you have to encourage the youth that don't do the same thing you do. So while I was in prison, I had to uplift people. Even when I'm out here going to church, testifying in church, talking to the youth out here, talking to the youth at work. No, I can't be angry because it's all glory to God. I have to do the mission that he had me to put me on. So no, I'm not angry. I'm at peace.
You better preach.
Amen.
Anybody, come on, open house. How we look, Miss Timekeeper Ebony?
We still have some time. We're at 7:40 right now, so we got a few more minutes left. So if anybody has any questions, you know.
This is a great conversation.
Let's keep it going, y'all.
So right now, what's next? I know you said you have lawyers set up for about your conviction. But what's next for you? Like,
because the state of Maryland has a law that anybody that was under age of 18 that never had a license, you have to wait 18 months. So you have to have your provisional license, which I have. Right. And in the summer, mine's will be up. Then I can go get my regular driver license. Once I get that, I'll be going to school for my CDL license. So I'll be driving 18-wheelers and dump trucks. That'd be my full-time job. That'd be my career.
You better go head on.
Yeah, so that's
what we wish you nothing but the best, bro. Yeah.
Amen, sure. Stan. Thank you. Amen.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Come on, anybody. What about some of these fellas? Mark, are you still with us?
Do you have any children?
No, ma'am. I'm not married and don't have any children.
Okay. Do you want to have a family?
No, I never wanted any children ever since I was small. Never wanted any children.
I hear you. I agree. Cool.
Mm-hmm. Hey, just off the record, quick answer. Which facility were you in here in Maryland?
I started in the Maryland State Penitentiary in Baltimore, Maryland. Then I went to it used to be called the Maryland House Correction Annex. Then they changed it to JCI, Justice Correctional Institution. And then I went to Hagerstown and back to Jessup. And then I went to Southern Maryland Pre-Release Unit. And that's when I came home from there.
So, hey, man, how do you see? Go ahead, Amber. You go.
I was just thinking, like, he had a great upbringing. How did, from your perspective and from whatever your parents told you, how did it affect them? How did it affect the family?
Well, what I told you. The only thing I regret is that from disrespect my mother and father, because it became the separation in my mother and father. My father moving out, getting his own house. I fought myself that I put that on them. That became a separation. I was hurt because of that. His illness of him being sick me not being there to be able to take care of him. Say like he came to see me Saturday. When he came to see me Saturday, he was falling over. So it was like God speak to me like, this is the last time you will see your father. So I'm looking at him. I'm saying he can ready to go. So say like he passed Saturday or Sunday. My mother came to see me Saturday. So she like, I got something to tell you. I said, Mom, no, daddy gone. That was one. Two, my mother, her being sick. I was in the visiting room. They came and seen me. They said, Mr. Bow, you got to move down. You have an elderly person come see you. I said, sure, I don't have nobody elderly in my family. They like, nah, they said you got to move down because if you're on a cane or you're in a wheelchair, you can't get over the benches. You got to sit at the end. I moved down. My sister came in. She gave me a wave. I just wasn't feeling it. It wasn't real. Something wasn't right. My mother came around in that cane. That was the worst visit I had 30 years. That's the worst visit I had 30 years. Seeing my mother in that cane, and I wasn't there to be able to take care of that, like, crushed me. So I told my sister, I whispered in her ear, said, look, we ain't going to be able to stay on this visit. You're going to have to leave. I ain't going to be able to see mom like that. So my mission was to fight harder so I can get out here to take care of my mother. So I'm here. That's what I'm doing. I'm at peace. I'm happy. I got a part-time job. I might make $300 every Friday. Guess what? I'm happy. I don't have the money. I ain't rich, but I ain't locked up. I'm struggling, but I'm still at peace because I know God is going to make it better for me. So I'm just taking my steps day by day, just waiting for the end and light of my tunnel, receive my blessings.
Right, because I was thinking, like, when I asked that, I wondered if your parents felt like when they separated, we failed our child. You know what I'm saying? Like, we failed.
It was a fault. It was a fault on all of us. It was a fault on me. That caused a friction in the parents. Right. It was hard on them to see me being gone. It was hard for my father to come see me locked up. It was hard for my brother to come see me locked up. You know what I'm saying? So it's basically just my mother and sister just taking care of everything because they couldn't deal with it. So yes, it separates the family. They'll tell you when you first go in prison that you're not the only one doing this time, that your family is doing it with you. And I didn't know that, but I dragged my family into my lifestyle. And it put a burden. It made them miserable, depressed, and stressed out from all the stuff that I had to take them through from being in there.
Anybody want to wrap up everything? Ebony, it's your show. You can call how you want to do it, but let's bring it to a close. Anybody got a question that they didn't get in or a question that needs to be asked that we didn't get in?
I have a question, if it's okay.
I'm open-minded. I'm not stuck in a box. I don't have no skeletons in the closet. I accept all questions. I'm not that type of person. Wherever you want to talk about, whoever, I talk about any and everything.
My question is, if you could go back and talk to your 17-year-old self as you today, what would you say?
Oh, most definitely. I would have kept my job, stayed in school, and stayed in church and Bible study, and listened to my mom and father. That's easy. Ain't no if, and, bust about it, because when I did all that, I was doing good. But once I put all that to the side, that's when my life went down here. So that's it. That's all, because I was doing good. That was the way of life. I did everything that I was supposed to do. I didn't fall off course till I stopped doing all that to go live the street life. So that's easy. That's what I've been told myself at a young age, if I can start all over again.
Do you feel even stronger than you were at 16?
Almost physically and mentally.
I mean, you know what? That's really a dumb question.
No, that's not. No, it's not, Mr. Stan. It's not, because the things that I seen in prison, I seen the best of the best that was strong in the street and became weak in prison. I mean, just gave up. So no, that's not a dumb question. That's a good question. I feel more stronger than when I was 16 that I'm 50 now, because the pain and suffering that I endured in there, I had to encourage myself every day. You see what I'm saying? Because if you don't, you'll give up. And I've seen so many people give up. I've seen people commit suicide. I've seen people OD on drugs. You see what I'm saying? So you have to make yourself strong to be able to do this pain and get over the hump. So that's where all my strength and energy and motivation come back. I had to stay in that talking slang, which is a hellhole, being miserable, depressed, and stressed out every day, locked in the cell 24 hours a day with another man. You're not in there by yourself. You're in there with another human being. So y'all have to bathe, use the bathroom together, eat together. The size of your bathroom, that's you. Locked behind that door. So I hadn't do that. So I had to strengthen myself. So most definitely I feel stronger. That's why I'm out here just going over these humps and hurdles, which is nothing to me. It's like a duck is just rolling off my back, and I'm going to keep on pushing and keep on moving. I'm not going to let nothing stop me to get in my way from accomplishing my goals, what I'm going to do and what I'm achieving in life.
Somebody asked Mr. Jermaine for me regarding how was the world when you got out, faster or slower? Okay. Anybody? Revamp that question for me, if you get what I'm saying. What were the
things
you had to get used to?
Yeah.
Go ahead, Amber, if you want.
How are you able to adapt to our society now? Because this is crazy for me, so how for you?
Yes, all praise to God. Thank God for family members, because if you didn't have family members to help you transition in society, you would fall and crumble. So my help of my brothers, sisters, nieces and nephews and relatives and friends taught me how to use a cell phone, taught me how to use a computer so I can be of a just society. One of the things I prayed before I left prison, I said, Lord, I need you to retransform my mind. First and foremost, I need you to put this prison lifestyle out of me, which would you be institutionalized? Because when you've been doing something for 30 years, that's all you know how to do. I'm ready to come home to society. You can't come out here with that mindset. You have to come out here and transfer your mind how they function out here in society. So I need to learn how to adapt, how they talking, how they speaking, email, chat, text messages. They don't use that terminology in prison. So that's what I had to do. So my culture shock of coming home is the technology. And everything, when I was here in 1989, was all dirt and trees and woods. Now everything is knocked down. It's all building and stores. So when you driving in your own neighborhood, Maryland, D.C., you looking, what used to be there is not there no more. It's something big and something new. So that was my culture shock of transitioning back into society.
Madam Ebony?
Yeah, so we're at 7:48, and I think we're pretty good right now. Anybody has any like wrapping up question? Anybody? I think we're making really good time, actually.
Jermaine, wow. I think this is a good sign. When they can't come up with questions, that means you've answered everything above and beyond. That's what that says. That's a real good sign.
Well, that's something that I prayed about, that I can be able to help y'all in y'all college class and also help y'all to be able to help other people. So I just ask God to let his spirit be here and let it be peaceful and do what he's supposed to do. So I just always leave it in God's hand.
I hear you, bro. You're really an inspiration, Jermaine.
Thank you.
Hey, please hold on to my phone number. You still got it?
Yes, sir.
Because we're going to be doing some things down the road.
Yes,
even
sir.
A podcast. Yes, sir. Even do a podcast next month. So I'll be back in touch.
Yes, sir.
And once we put all this together, I'll call you to let you know so you can go to our website and see how the interview turned out tonight.
Yes, sir. Yes, I appreciate it.
Man, I really appreciate you.
Already in my
Thank
phone.
You so much.
I got you in my contacts. I got Ebony in my contact. Call me, text me. Y'all want me to come to a speaking engagement, just text me. My baby mother, wife, girlfriend is Waze. All I do is put the address in. She gets me everywhere I need to go because I ride by myself.
Say that again, your baby wife, what?
My baby mother, my wife, and my girlfriend is Waze. Waze is all you got to do is give me the address. I tell her, and she'll get me to wherever I need to go. She's been faithful to me. She haven't cheated on me since I've been home because I don't have a wife. I don't have a baby mother. I don't have a girlfriend. So Waze, that's my female that be talking to the truck to me. Yeah.
You ever thought about going into comedy?
Hey, I mean, they always said, if you get me on stage, I'm ready. I need the money. They give me the money, I do it. I need the money. Anything that I can do job-wise, legally, give me the address, I do. Because I cut grass. People need stuff hauled out of their backyard, out of their house. Here go my card. Here go my number. I put it on my calendar. Give me your address. I put it in the ways. I get it out your house. Take it to the dump, give me my money. I can go give me some gas, give me some food, get me something to eat to take care of myself.
Are you in Baltimore? Or
no,
are you down in PG?
Yeah, Prince George's County, Maryland.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right.
What do you do for fun?
That's a good question. What happened was my literate mind getting caught up in the neighborhood stuff, thinking that what was lame, what black people don't do. I didn't have a chance. I never been on a plane, train, didn't go educate myself. So I do everything, anything. You call me and you say you want to go to a museum, a zoo, a show, I'm coming. I'm going because of my lack of experience that I never got to experience nothing in my life. I do everything. So anything that's entertainment that's going to put a smile on my face that I'm going to enjoy, we can go.
Hey, let me ask you a quick question, Jermaine. What's the difference in your world between not knowing how to read and then becoming literate? What's the joy and beauty of that?
It was so beautiful because when you locked in that cell and you in them four walls and the walls getting closed on, you got to learn how to read these books to get your mind off this cell. So when I'm reading, it put me that I was on that scene or wherever I was at in them books, that's where I was at. So my body was in this prison cell, but my mind was on the street. So it became very beautiful to be able to educate myself, to learn more by me becoming the how to read. I'm not at the best, I'm not the top, but I'm not like I was when I went in. So I'm happy and I'm at peace. And also to learn how to spell, because the technology, emailing, text messages, I have to do that. I have to do these text messages. I have to do these emails. So I have to learn how to hit these keys on this computer and on this phone. So I'm happy, I'm at peace.
Did you have to fake it at first and then learn how to read?
In prison?
Yeah.
Oh, most definitely. You vulnerable. You can't let nobody know your weakness in prison. They're going to attack you. And I'm 17, too. Oh, yeah. You can't let that be known. Oh,
but
no, sir.
So my point is, okay, you're 17. You can't read. I've lost my train of thought for a second. But here you are. Would you say that's your greatest accomplishment in life? Being able to comprehend words after earlier struggling with that.
The best thing that I did in prison for my 30 years was to get my GED. That was the most happiest time in prison, was to get my GED. When I passed that GED, Mr. Stan, and got my certificate and I graduated, I had my hat and gown on. That was my best experience in life, getting my GED. The most important thing I did in prison.
I hear you, brother. You said that right to the point.
Yes.
Hey, we're going to end with that, Jermaine. We're going to end with that.
Hold on. Is it possible to get one more question then from Tavon?
Sure,
yeah, Tavon. Sure. He had one more question, and then we can wrap it up.
Okay.
Go ahead, Tavon.
Mr. Bolden, I know a lot of people do different things once they get out and stuff like that. And my question was, what was the first thing that you got to eat once you got out? Because I know some people, they go to McDonald's or something like that. Like, what was the first thing, like something that you just had to have once you got out the system?
Man, I already said it from day one. I'm going to church to say a prayer. That's because I stopped going to church and Bible said I owe God that. But I couldn't go to church because the COVID was down. All the churches was closed down. So the second was to go to the graveyard and see my father, visit my father's grave site, straight off the top. Went there, visited my father's grave site, came home to my mother and father's house, and I stayed up all night with my mother. We just talked to 5 o'clock in the morning. I ain't gonna get nothing to eat. That's gonna happen. I ain't tripping about that. People think I was gone because they thought you've been out of 30, were you going to strip club, going to club? Look, I did that. I'm through with that life. I'm not going back to life. So I ain't going to no club. I ain't going to strip club. I ain't messing with no woman for a year and a half. I had to get myself together. See, that's where you get messed up, because you come out here and you get caught up. That's what put me in prison, chasing that lifestyle, impressing females, impressing women. I put all that to the side, Tavon. What I did, I came ahead and got myself together first, because before I can be able to get with you or to be able to help somebody else out, you got to get yourself together first. So I've been gone for 30 years. I had to get myself together. So I was focused. I had the horse blinders on. I ain't lived to the left, to the right. I did what I had to do to get myself established. So that's what I did when I came on church, visit my father's grave site, and then I came in this house. I didn't hit the streets. I didn't do nothing. I just spent time with my family.
That's
they did home cooking. We ate home cooking stuff.
Yeah. What did y'all eat? Like, was it fried chicken? Like,
Oh, yeah. My sister cooked. She had that baked chicken, macaroni and cheese, greens, cornbread, cake. What else was it? String beans. And I think that was it. Yeah, we did home cooking in the house. Yeah.
Well, yeah. You was eating good, Mr. Bowen. You was eating good, brother.
Yeah, I ate home cooked. I didn't want restaurant food. Oh, because I'm going to tell you why, Tavon. Were you in the prison system and you've been eating something for so long, for 30 years? You know, when you come out here, a lot of time when you eat food, you know, your body don't adjust to it. So it runs through you. So you have to flush your system out first from the detoxation of the prison food to be able to slowly start eating this rich society food. So I didn't go into any restaurants first. I was eating a lot of home food, and then I started going out. Because even COVID was out, a lot of restaurants was closed anyway. So I was eating a lot of house food.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
All right, that's something new. I never knew that. That's interesting.
Yeah, because the prison food is totally different from society food. So a lot of times people can get sick and stuff. You'll throw it up because it's rich, or it just run right through you. So you have to adjust your body and flush your system out, because now you come into a whole different lifestyle of food that you're putting inside your system.
Right.
So you got to detoxify yourself.
Mm-hmm. Well, a million thanks, Jermaine, and I'm going to be in touch with you. Okay. I will be in touch with you probably in the next 3 weeks or so, once we put this all together. So yes. I look forward to talking to you again soon, bro. Thank you so much, man.
Can I get a copy? Y'all will send me a copy too, Mr. Stein?
Yeah, we can make that happen.
Okay. All right, y'all call me. Y'all need me to come to college, speak, or speak in the game, just call me. And if I don't answer because I'm asleep, because I got to go to work, just text me, and then when I get up, I'll call y'all.
Okay, man. It's on me. I got you. I will be back in touch.
Okay, nice to meet y'all. Thank y'all.
Nice meeting you. Thank you so much.
Okay, you got a great smile. Keep smiling.
Amen. Thank you. Take care.
Yes, sir. Have a good night now.
All right.
Bye-bye.
All right.